Well, I was dreading opening up Facebook that morning. I'd gotten into this dialogue with a supposed independent, and it was getting pretty heated. They didn't come off as very independent, and they kept essentially taking an extremely conservative line and attacking the previous administration and even what Hillary Clinton had and hadn't done. I strained to keep the dialogue civil. But he was starting to attack my intelligence and my character. I was feeling a little triggered. So far, I'd managed to hang on to the credo that Michelle Obama and I both love. When they go low, we go high. But my sarcasm was starting to leak out. It's a sneaky thing, sarcasm. All of a sudden, thank you very much doesn't mean thank you very much at all. So I needed to tread cautiously. As my French roasted and pressed coffee did its job, I took a deep breath and clicked. I was caught off guard. He started by saying, quote, "This has been, by far, the most enjoyable and pleasant argument I have ever had with a stranger on Facebook. Now, while I don't agree with all of your opinions, you've stated them in such a way that I will continue to ponder them long after this thread has died. I wish more Americans could argue this way. I think we'd be a better country if we could. Thank you." Well, I was stunned. As I had alluded to, he'd started suggesting I was stupid for what I'd written. And stupid is such a heart-opening word, right? Sorry, there goes my sarcasm again. So I really had to strain to stay focused on his argument, his fears, his concerns, and his passions. Now, maybe I should go back here and just state a few things. I have this very old school belief about why we should argue and what an argument should look like. Let me put this out there, and you guys can tell me later what you think. I believe that the primary purpose of argument or debate is to persuade, and ultimately through some mutual persuasion process, create a respectful connection felt by both parties. Now, for some, that may seem obvious. I would argue that we don't act this way when we argue in public places. Current culture has us arguing to destroy, to annihilate, to ruin, to shame, and to completely defeat our opponents. That's what the talking heads do on TV news programs or even during presidential debates. The problem is that winning ends up being a short-term victory at best, in much the same way that negative campaign ads can be effective. They also create greater voter apathy and a desire to withdraw from the system. They rarely leave us feeling good about the political waters in which we all swim. Arguing to destroy another is like a battle to the death, winner take all. Arguing to persuade is more like a tennis match or fencing. There is honor and respect for one's opponent, and there are very specific, mutually agreed upon rules of order for the engagement process. Now, I'm guessing about now many of you are starting to reflect upon exchanges you've had with a rogue family member, perhaps. Sometime around the holidays, perhaps, when it seemed like there was just no point in even attempting to engage, much less persuade. And there may be some truth there, of course, but how should we navigate discussions that may arise over cranberries and stuffing so that they don't, A, turn into a food fight, or B, turn into that awkward moment where no one but the pontificator states their controversial views and everyone wants to lead the discussion, if not the room? Time and place. Choose your battles, of course. But if we can't or don't want to avoid the conversation, what should we do? Well, that's what I'd like to talk about today. Now, if you'll accept on a provisionary basis my supposition that we should be arguing to persuade, then the very first thing we have to talk about are ad hominem attacks, otherwise known as insults. Contrary to our president's propensity to insult any and all, if we want someone to even marginally consider what we're saying, we cannot insult them. We might be able to bully or shame them into submission, but that is not persuasion. Just the opposite. No, if we believe there is even a glimmer of hope to persuade someone, even just a tiny bit, we immediately have to remove character attacks off the table. And that's hard. I know. I mean, how many of us have been disagreeing with someone and thought to ourselves, well, they're just not very smart or well-educated? Be honest. I know some of you are probably looking for those lose and loose and the misspelled it's, and you're probably just ready to lose it completely. They probably have bad teeth and a still in the backyard. It would be so easy to make a joke at their expense. And I'm definitely clever enough that they wouldn't even see that I'm making fun of them. Very tempting indeed. Or maybe they can spell, but they show up like privileged, conservative, heartless elites who feel that they shouldn't pay a progressive income tax, or they're so cut off from those who suffer, so selfishly wrapped up in their world of comfort that they look down their noses on those who need a hand up or a leg up. The point is that there are many triggers out there for everyone, but we will not get what we want from an argument if we go for the cheap shot. We will not receive any opening, any transformation in our opponent or those who witness the debate. Insults basically tell your opponents to plug their ears, wait until your mouth stops moving, and then continue with their equal and opposite character assassination of you. So as the children's story notes, the approach is also in direct opposition to our first three sacred principles. So instead, what if we were to just listen? Listen to their energy, their passion. Listen to understand, not judge their point of view. When does their voice rise? Or when do you see all caps and lots of exclamation points on Facebook? To truly listen, we may have to ignore any suggestions on their part that we're dumb, isolated, stupid, a snowflake, or whatever. What if we could disregard those and listen to where their fire is, their passion? The next step for me in this process is ask questions, but ask questions to understand, not judge. And again, then listen to understand their answers, not judge them. Now, oh, believe me, I know how hard that sounds. To both listen and ask questions without judgment. But if the ultimate goal is to persuade, to open another person even slightly to our point of view, we have to remove judgment from the process. Now, don't worry. There's plenty of time for that later. We never lose our judgment muscles. You know, unlike my abs, they get plenty of crunches. When we ask genuine, non-rhetorical questions about another person's argument, four interesting things begin to happen. One, it's disarming. If the questions are genuine, there's very little to actually argue about. Two, it's constructively disruptive. It calls a timeout of sorts. Momentum ceases. It buys us a little time to think and strategize. Three, we're showing interest in their thought process, their side of the aisle. We all have egos, so showing genuine interest in someone else's mind will invariably relax, if not charm, the other person to some degree. And the fourth thing that happens is that we actually require them to work through and support their own argument. Now, how successful we are with that process, or how successful they are with that process in their own mind, can also create doubt while opening up possibilities of how we might respond with counterarguments, all by simply asking honest questions. Okay, so if we've done all that prep work, now comes the time to respond, right? So usually the first thing I do is honor their view. Now, sometimes all that means is restating it as objectively and fairly as I can. Now, I know I succeeded when they say, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Because then, we can respond to exactly what they're saying. With this groundwork laid, the next thing I like to do is to note agreement. Our opponent is going to be more open and better behaved if we can find some part of their argument to agree with. They'll trust us more. In a similar vein, somewhere in our response, it can help to acknowledge at least one point of theirs. Give them a bone. Own something. Concede a point and see where it leads. For example, for all the good it's done, I believe that Democrats need to acknowledge that Obamacare or the ACA is not perfect. It has problems and needs improvement. Even President Obama acknowledges that. If we're defending it, that could be a concession. Another approach, which I enjoy personally a lot, is to poke a little fun at yourself, your opinion, or whatever group is supporting your opinion. Let them know that you're not an absolutist. Hey, I'm okay with being wrong here and there. Everything our team does is not perfect or right. The underlying subconscious truth here is that only people secure in their beliefs can do this. It may sound odd to say this, but admitting fallibility can actually strengthen an argument and create more trust. Binary thinking leads to one of two things. Always. That's why it's called binary thinking. Avoid the binary stand of yes or no, red state or blue state, on or off. Life and even our two-party political system is not a light switch. If you must use that metaphor, think of it as a dimmer switch. And if you're having a bad day, you can imagine your opponent's intelligence similarly, if it brings some comic relief. Now, I know many of you are familiar with Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication, so you'll know that empathy, even contrived, formulaic empathy, because he actually gives you the actual sentences to slot words into, can lead to connection. Rosenberg's research points to literally wearing down your opponent with long stretches of verbalized empathy. And it might help to remember sometimes that our goals, our ends, are not really all that dissimilar. We can't really say with absolute certainty whose means are going to achieve similar goals. Reagan probably frightened the Soviet Union and Gorbachev into the best relationship we've ever had with them. But his means, like joking about a nuclear attack on Moscow, were awful. Oh, and I promise that this phrase will not bring you closer to anyone, even the person who loves you most in the world, if you use it to express something you disagree about. You always... Just trust me on this one. Absolutes should be avoided also because they're impossible to defend. It's easy to find an exception to an absolute. Wendell Johnson probably nailed it best when he said, quote, "Always and never are two words you should always remember to never use." I love that quote. Generally speaking, it's good to avoid generalizations. Always avoid generalizations. Never use them. We should be backing up our assertions with short, simple data. If we over-document and expect our opponent to go and read 24 links that we posted on Facebook, we'll lose them. Nobody cares about our point of view like we do. So we should do our own research and then summarize. If they want more, trust me, they'll ask. Now, I believe that we should debate as if there are rules in play and we're all in community. We can bring these up from time to time if we need to, but I like to act as if they're already there. I think I argue better when I do that. And by the same token, it's fair to call out an opponent for character attacks, especially if they're unable to argue without them. Now, it's hard not to say condescending as I say this, but it's a teachable moment. You're teaching them a better way to argue, a better way to be. Now, all of these techniques will not work all of the time. Sometimes we stumble across someone who is just too triggered in their anger and fear to really hear us. And it's okay to respectfully excuse ourselves from the table if everything we have tried has failed. I think my hope is that this is a last resort after exhausting the power of civil discourse to transform. Now, I want to leave you with a story today. I was living and working in D.C. as an intern for an anti-nuclear group in the fall of 1984 when Walter Mondale was effectively trounced by President Reagan. I was living with one of my best friends, Tom. At that time, I always kind of felt like Tom was a little too good for me. He was more politically correct, always fighting the best fight. And politically correct was actually a term that we coined in student government in 83, 84. But on the whole, Tom just seemed more evolved than me. But he managed to do so while also being a very warm and compassionate person. I later learned he was raised UU. Halloween night, we ended up at a friend's loft in Georgetown with some makeshift costumes and makeup to look ghoulish. Tom was ready before me, and I was in the bathroom mirror trying to draw something on my face that looked cool or scary. DC was hopping that night. He wandered outside and met a tipsy woman our age who was definitely ahead of us in her celebration. She invited herself in. I came out, met her briefly, and then returned to the bathroom mirror to work on my face. I could hear their conversation clearly in the other room. I laughed now and then as she was entertainingly buzzed and talked loudly about anything and everything. Then, all of a sudden, she used the N-word. And not just once. She started talking about how much she didn't like boop, and I heard Tom interrupt her and simply say, "Please don't use that word. I don't like it." She laughed and thought he was kidding and then used it again. And Tom interrupted her immediately and said, "Please stop. That word hurts me. Please do not use it in my presence." Now, I grew up in Texas in the 1960s, and I heard that word far too many times. It always felt like a gunshot going off, and it made me flinch. It was harsh and hateful, but I never knew as a kid how to tell people to stop using it in my presence. Tom was leading a clinic on how to do just that. The girl was a little flustered and possibly too intoxicated to get that Tom was deeply offended. She was in our space using this hateful language, but still thought it was some kind of a joke. She used the word again, and Tom interrupted her and said, and I'll never forget this, "Please stop using that word. It hurts me. It upsets me. If you continue using it, I will have to leave the room." Wow. Well, I just never heard anyone talk like that before. I'd completely stopped trying to do my makeup, and I was standing in the door with my jaw on the floor. There was a long 3 to 4 second pause, and suddenly she began apologizing profusely. She said again and again and again that she was sorry, and she'd been totally rude, and this was our house, and she deeply regretted offending him. It was like a bad scripted transformational scene from a film. I was beaming. I was so proud of my friend Tom. He didn't even insist that she leave, but said that he would have to leave to protect his heart. I'd never seen anything like it. She was very contrite and begged us to still come along with us on our pub crawl, and we both said it was okay as long as she watched her language. At some point later, we lost her to the chaos of the night, but that was okay. Tom never insulted her. He never told her she was wrong. He never even demanded that she get out of our house, and as such, he awakened her. He persuaded her. He got through to her. Now, I have no idea how much she remembered the next day, but I have never forgotten. Oh, my friends, don't give up. Words matter. Please don't give up and stop taking the high road. Remember that the most great lessons in life are modeled and not taught. If we can be the embodiment of civil discourse, our message will be clearer than even the most passionate speech from the greatest orator. While we clearly remember the words, many of the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi, it was their embodiment of their philosophy that communicated across the divide. Psychologist Jan Iverson says, quote, "Integrity is the distance between who we want to be and who we are." So who do we want to be? Do we want to aspire to the beautiful ethical ideas in our seven principles? If so, we probably have to step out of our echo chambers, not to judge, but to listen and learn. As civil rights lawyer Brian Stevenson said at GA, we need to get proximate. It may be one of the only solutions available to us. Now, Brian was speaking about proximity to incarcerated people or people who struggle on the fringes of society. But the same applies to people with points of view that we're far away from. It can really help to seek out and build relationships with an independent who seems to tilt conservative if you're liberal, or vice versa. Our progressive liberal faith is a blessed sanctuary where I rarely feel the need to defend my political and social views. But that can work against us. It can work against us understanding a more nuanced and broader political spectrum in which we live. Also, the anonymity of the internet has not been our friend. While it does allow us to instantly communicate with people all over the world, it's not true proximity. There is no eye contact. There is a very weak social construct in place that pales in comparison to what running into a total stranger at Trader Joe's would look like. These techniques can and should be used online, but to get proximate, we need real FaceTime in the real world. Find people who hold opinions that are dissimilar from yours and practice some of these techniques. It's easy to avoid insulting someone you're standing in front of, but is it just as easy to listen openly, ask questions for understanding and not judgment, to find agreement between what may seem like two very disparate points of view? No, it's not. And that's probably why it's a good idea to try once in a while. I invite us to turn our binary light switches into dimmer switches. Truth is never absolute. Relative truth sits in relationship to specific people, institutions, and events. You can have a much more interesting conversation with anyone if you can take absolute truth off the table. As you use, we believe that each and every person is important. All people should be treated fairly and kindly, and that we should accept one another and keep on learning together. Magic words. So, just wave a wand, right? Let's get cracking. I hope that some of these techniques can help us continue to go high, regardless of how low others go, and I think we will be a better people if we can. May it be so. Blessed be.